Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame-Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual. And this is the Shame-Free Zone with your host, Veronica Monet. I want to welcome you to call in with any comments or questions you might have today. That toll-free number is 888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494. Or if you're a little shy about the telephone, you can do what everybody else does and just send me a message over on Facebook or Twitter. My Twitter address is twitter.com/Veronica Monet. And Facebook, go over to Facebook and look for Veronica Monet. I believe I'm the only one there. Okay, and I will be reading Twitter and Facebook comments live as we proceed. Today's topic, it's a taboo one. We're going to be talking about religious shame. Now, as I understand the history books, shame pretty well originates with religion. It's, you know, kind of difficult sometimes to know exactly which came first because they both go back so far that they pretty much predate written history. But usually when you find references to things that are meant to cause us to feel ashamed or guilty, it is within a religious context. And then gradually this gets taken over by other social mediums like the educational system and, of course, the government. But today we're going to actually tackle some of those really unwieldy topics, and I think they're kind of taboo topics, you know. And I just want to preface this discussion with the fact that this is not in any way meant to be an attack on people's personal faith or anybody who might consider themselves a Christian or a Muslim or a Jew or any other of the monotheistic patriarchal religions. But I do want to have an honest conversation about some of the less fortunate byproducts of monotheistic patriarchal religions. So joining me today, I'm very happy to say I've got my friend Paul, who is a former English professor who's calling in from North San Juan, California. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Veronica.
And my other very special guest is Gerald Stinnett, who is calling in from the eastern side of the state of Washington. And one of the reasons that Paul, no offense, but Jerry is a very special guest in my estimation because he happens to be my cousin. And, you know, as they say, blood is thicker than water. So, Jerry, welcome to the Shame-Free Zone.
Thank you, Veronica.
I'm very honored to have you here. And to kick the show off, I'd actually like Jerry to tell me some things that he was telling me earlier today, because he's had a bit of trauma, emotional trauma this week, thanks to some well-meaning Christian relatives. And this would be a great way for us to kind of start our discussion, if you're open to sharing what happened to you this week, Jerry.
Yes. My sister called me and asked me why I hadn't responded to her letters, and I said, well, I didn't respond, but I chose not to mail the letters, because what she had told me in the letter was that I was going to go to hell because I was a homosexual and a non-repentant homosexual. And I said, well, what did you think I should do as a homosexual? If I love Jesus and accept him as my Christ, what else should I do? Well, she said, get rid of your homosexual partner. And so that was the beginning of the conversation. And what I find is ironic is that she could be married to someone who had already been married, and according to Christ's teaching, that would be adultery. And if she asks for forgiveness, it's automatically forgiven her. But as a homosexual, I can never be forgiven as long as I have my partner. So, you know, that's the an hour-long discussion with her.
Yeah. And just to, for our listeners, your partner's name is Rob, and you guys have been together for how many years?
7 years.
7 years. And I just want to say I visited you in your home. It's a lovely, well-kept home. You guys have got beautiful landscaped yard with a four head of cattle and a beautiful organic garden. And you know, you're just such a talented, special person. You're a fabulous painter. You've got an obvious knack for growing things, whether it's cattle or gardens, because, you know, it's just, like, perfect when I walk into your home. It's just, like, a perfect little picture book. And, you know, there's just so much joy and happiness and love in your home and light in your eyes and affection going back and forth between you and your partner. And it breaks my heart to think that, especially somebody that is closely related to you, like your sister, is so blind with hatred and prejudice that she can't see all of this love that your lifestyle has created on planet Earth.
Yeah, Veronica, could I say something about that? This is
yeah,
Paul.
Please do, Paul.
Well, having gone through Catholic schools and a Catholic college and everything, I got to know some of the scripture. I'm a former Catholic. But, you know, this woman is setting herself up as a judge and jury. Only one entity decides who goes to heaven or hell, and that's God, you know. And there is a line in the Bible, judge not lest ye be judged. This woman is putting herself in God's position. That's blasphemy. She has no right to do that. And she's not God, and she can't tell someone how to achieve redemption or salvation or anything like that. That's between a person and their God, and this woman seems to be butting into that relationship big time. It's just my observation.
Well, and a good one it is, but Jerry, she had an explanation for that, right? Didn't she quote you something from the Bible about how it was incumbent upon her to try to save your soul before you died?
Yes. She had heard that I was taking chemotherapy and wanted to make sure that I was saved. And there's a scripture in the Bible that talks about if a person is unrepentant, then the church should turn them over to Satan as a reprobate and let him destroy the body so Christ could save the soul. And that's what she wanted to do for me. And it breaks my heart.
That's nuts.
Yeah. That's, it's hard to even believe, but I when I hear things like that, it makes me think about the Christian missionaries who first came to the United States before it was the United States, when it was populated with Native Americans. And the basic premise, I summarize it like this. This, of course, is not the actual wording, but it is, I think, an accurate reflection of the actions that took place. And it was basically, give your heart to the Lord, or I will cut it out of you with a knife.
Veronica, I didn't know if you knew I was logged in here. I'd like to make a few comments about what Jerry's referring to, if you don't mind.
Is that you, Matt?
Yes, hi.
Hi, Matt. To the listeners out there, this is another one of my cousins. And, Matt, I'm going to let you introduce yourself because, you know, I don't know what level of anonymity everybody wants to assume here, but anything you want to tell us about where your location is and what you do for a living would
sure.
be awesome before you comment.
Sure. My name is Dr. Matt Piercy, and I live in Indiana. I direct the Student Achievement Program. But in my free time, I write about gay issues. Specifically, I research the issue of mixed orientation marriages. So I look at relationships where one partner is heterosexual and one partner is gay. And what I've found in doing this study is that there are a lot of forces that come together to create this kind of phenomenon, and religion is a very strong one. What I wanted to comment on earlier in regards to Jerry's situation is I just find it so interesting that in modern American Christianity, that one of the, it's just very interesting that they pinpoint a few select issues as problems. Homosexuality is one of them. Abortion is one of them. But they don't look at a lot of other sins that people who are Christian themselves engage in quite a bit. They're not railing against it. But if you look at places, organizations like Focus on the Family, they, on their website, have a very specific and large effort put toward talking about homosexuality. But they forget about lots of other kinds of sins. So I think it's very selective, and it just reminds me that religion, and even the Bible, has infused into it all of our personal difficulties, our failings as humans. And so, the Bible itself is not an entirely divine document. So if people can just recognize that religion has infused into it the filter that we all have, then it makes it a little bit easier to kind of understand where many Christians who seem unloving are coming from.
Well, one of the things that really bothers me, and especially in the context of our family of origin, is the idea that people who are doing some really horrific things, like beating their wives or children or molesting their children, would hide behind the Bible and hide behind their religion in as a way to throw up kind of a smoke screen to their activities, so that they're actually creating harm and ruining lives in the name of the Lord. And, I noticed for myself growing up, I felt like a black sheep of the family because I wasn't ascribing to the religious dictums that were being, thrown at me. And there'd be like the call to the altar at grandma's funeral. There was a call to the altar for every Thanksgiving dinner. And so I was constantly being assaulted with this idea that I was falling short. I was not a good Christian. I wasn't a good human being. Then to years later find out that these very same people who were inflicting all of this guilt and shame were actually committing such horrific acts that they probably should have been, and in some cases absolutely should have been, behind bars in a prison somewhere, is kind of a mind-bending experience for me, because then I have to kind of recast myself as the good guy to this story, because, I'm very grateful to say I've never done a prosecutable, felonious act against a child.
Absolutely.
And it almost seems like that it becomes the, because people will say, well, this is, there's a few bad eggs, or there's a few, and I don't really buy that. My experience has been that the more vehemently you persecute a certain group of people, it's like J. Edgar Hoover was with the Red Scare, trying to get everybody prosecuted for being communist, and in a lot of ways it was a smokescreen because he was a closeted homosexual and cross-dresser who didn't want to get found out. And then we're finding this to be the case for a lot of ministers and pastors and priests that are out there preaching about the evils of homosexuality, and it turns out that they're actually not comfortable with their own sexuality, and that they may be seeing male prostitutes or have lovers on the side. And this becomes a way of basically expressing their own internalized homophobia.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that, Matt?
Well, I think you're quite right. I mean, someone asked me the other day why I thought that the pre-scandals had occurred in the Catholic Church. And of course, I'm not a Catholic, and I have been to a lot of Catholic churches in my life and dated a few Catholics. Love them to death. But what I found to be true is that there are a lot of forces, a lot of sociological forces that cause people to go into religion that, are, like you say, a smokescreen for what they're really feeling. I mean, a lot of priests become priests because they don't want to come out as gay because there's a lot of social disapproval for that. So they go into the church so that they can be married to God. But then their need to have sexual contact comes out, but it comes out in an inappropriate manner. It's just like the men who end up getting married to straight women but who are actually gay. You know, when you suppress or repress your feelings for too long, it ends up coming out in bad ways. And so most of these men have been very, very sick physically, have been alcoholic, have all sorts of mental difficulties, a lot of depression. And I think for Catholic priests, when they suppress their feelings, it comes out in really negative ways by inappropriately touching young men and having inappropriate relationships with them. When if they were able to come out in main society, they would be able to affect a more positive kind of relationship. You know, I always find it humorous in a kind of a sad way when men will write me or when I interact with men who try to justify why they're closeted as it being somehow better or more psychologically sound for them, when in fact there's all sorts of psychological studies that show that coming out of the closet relieves all sorts of stress. You don't have to put all that energy towards pretending to be something else. So I find it in the gay community, the whole idea of, quote, being straight acting, I find it to be a really negative term.
You know, I used to teach in a Catholic school, and so I got to know some of the priests and nuns. They're very protective of the institution, the Mother Church. And at the other end of this whole thing is, why is it the Church covered up this? Why did they conceal it? Why did they basically create their own scandal by not admitting it? And the main thrust seems to be that they don't want to admit that people in the church did anything wrong, and they want to protect Mother Church because they're so self-righteous, because they're doing God's work, because, you know, they're doing Christ's mission and all this stuff. And as a result, for example, down in Oakland, where I used to live, the survivors, the people who survived being molested by the pedophile priests in the Diocese of Oakland, there was like a class action lawsuit, and they received basically $55 million. And so maybe it came out to, I don't know, $500,000 a person. But on the other hand, they got done building a new cathedral down near Lake Merritt, and they put $130 million into that. So their new church is more important to them than trying to rectify the wrong of their priests vis-a-vis molesting children in the church under the cloth of God, in my opinion.
Oh, well, I think that's pretty self-evident. I mean, numbers don't lie, right? You put your money where your mouth is. It shows what matters to you by how you spend your money. Absolutely.
Well, I mean, even if we're not talking about, you know, putting money towards child molestation, I mean, I went to a Catholic church last year, and it was my surprise. They were really working hard on the attendees to make more donations to a $1 million fund. And, you know, what they wanted to spend that money on was to buy a $1 million organ for their church. That's skewed thinking, because there are homeless people and all sorts of other people who are hungry, but they're worried about buying an organ.
Yeah, exactly. And another thing that turned me off on a separate topic, but to speak about going to church and getting turned off, one of the last times I attended a Catholic service down in the Bay Area was when the priest got in the pulpit and seriously told people in Oakland, it's okay if your life is miserable and you're broke and you're suffering and you're not making much money. The more pain you suffer on this life, the higher place you will have in heaven, you know. And all I could think about was the philosophy of Marx and Engels saying that religion is opium for the masses. And I figured, well, you know, I'm not going to church anymore because I come to church for some sort of inspiration. Instead, I'm just thinking that this is a real negative experience. So that was the beginning of me being a Catholic, frankly.
Well, that's one of the things that for me now, you know, I live a very spiritually centered life, and I believe in God, and I believe in the power of prayer. But it's non-denominational for me. I'm not attached to any particular organization or belief or faith. And as a matter of fact, I like to say that beliefs are dangerous. so I refuse to have any, except for that one, which is the beliefs are dangerous.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
I mean,
dogmatic beliefs, yeah, certainly. I get what you're saying there.
Well, what'd you say, Matt?
I said, yeah, certainly dogmatic beliefs that are inflexible. Yeah. I certainly agree with that, yeah.
Well, it's just, see, I see the same strains of religious fervor in the scientific community, and I find it really disturbing. It's almost as if, whether it's, you know, Republican, Democrat, evolutionist, creationist, it becomes like this club where you want to beat the rest of the world over the head with your brand of truth. And I think, you know, what would be nice is if people would start focusing on the fruits of their particular thought patterns and behavior patterns. Like, what am I actually creating? Just like in that example of $1 million organ versus, you know, having to trip over the homeless people to walk up the steps of your church. You know, like, acquaint yourself with the facts of your existence. What are you actually putting out into the world? Sometimes I think the big brain that this particular animal we are has gets in our way. We get so enamored with our own logical thought processes that we really can't even think straight anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And we miss the most obvious of things. You would think it would be totally obvious that $1 million on an organ while there are still homeless, children, and there's still hungry people right here in the United States, you would think that that would be self-evident as a complete waste of misappropriation of funds. But somehow or another, it's not, because the ego gets in there and says, we want our church to have this, and our church is going to have that, and we're going to own. And, the original mission, which I suppose, we're all supposed to be believing that the original mission of Christianity was to help the unfortunate. I'm not sure that really was the original mission. It seems to me like the original mission has actually been to serve as something of an adjunct to government. And gradually religion has been pushed out of government, but it still has a really strong role to play in U.S. government, because you cannot run for public office without professing some type of faith.
Hmm.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, like with Mitt Romney, he's a Mormon, right? And when I was teaching in a Catholic school, I taught comparative religions, and so I taught Mormonism, and I had guest speakers in as Mormons. And we were very clear. I asked the Mormons directly, well, you guys are not Christians because you don't believe that Christ is God. And the Mormons I talked to then said, yeah, very clearly, that even though it's the Church of Jesus Christ, of Latter-day Saints, Christ is perceived as a prophet, not God, like it is in religion. I mean, in Catholic. In the Catholic realm, Christ is God, the Trinity. But in the Mormon realm, Christ is the prophet, not God. And when Mitt Romney was running for office, you know, they always pretended to be Christians, and they weren't. So it's the strangest thing. I'm anxious to see him run again.
Yeah, well, I always think as an outsider to all of these little religious arguments about doctrine, I find them quite boring. Because I think, well, what are you accomplishing? I don't care. Fine, you're going to settle this argument. One of you will win the argument. But what will it have accomplished on planet Earth?
Yeah.
Jerry, are you still there, babe?
I'm still here, and I'm thinking that some people become so heavenly minded, they're no earthly good. And
that's really
great.
So heavenly minded, you're no earthly good.
Good. And I want to enjoy this beautiful life that God has given us, and whoever he or she may be, she doesn't give a hoot whether we're sexual or non-sexual or anything about us, as long as we're enjoying what we have. And if we forget to enjoy this life, we have neglected God and the gift. So, yeah, I'm not religious either, but in that respect, I want to enjoy my life to the fullest.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I think this whole focus on homosexuality, I think it has another hidden agenda, and I think it was reflected rather well in this video that my mother sent me about birth rate. And I found this video incredibly offensive and disturbing because it had been put out by Christians, and it was all about how the Muslims are out-populating, that there's in another 50 years, the world is going to be all Muslim because the Muslims are having all the babies and the Christians are not having enough babies to continue for there to be a Christian majority on planet Earth. So it's going to become all Muslims, and Muslims are going to run the world. And that was the gist of this whole video, and it was very much about fear politics. And then at the very end, it says, this is a call to action. Well, you know, I email my mother back, and I go, what action? I mean, what are you going to do, kill Muslims, or are you just going to try to have more sex than them and make more babies? I mean, what kind of call to action is that? And the best you could come up with is, well, the Christians have to stop killing their babies. And you know, so abortion comes in there as, you know, that's a taboo. And then, of course, we've got, you know, the Pope saying that condoms don't even work to prevent AIDS. So, you know, and birth control is against the church doctrine. Mm-hmm. When I was talking about birth control around my parents, they kept conflating it with abortion. And I finally just got frustrated and said, so is that it? When you say birth control, Christians hear abortion? And she's like, well, no, not necessarily, but, you know, kind of. So it seems like this idea that we must go forth and multiply, because that's in the Bible, you know, go forth and multiply.
Mm-hmm.
And in a lot of ways, I think, you know, the idea that homosexual sex is non-procreative sex kind of falls in line with that. Masturbation is non-procreative. And the whole emphasis seems to be on making more soldiers, more taxpayers, and more church members. What do you think about that, guys?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I agree. This is Paul. I agree totally. I saw that when I was teaching in a Catholic school. The reasons why Catholic priests don't get married is because if they did, they might have children that would inherit church property. So the Catholic priests don't get married and have children, but they want to encourage their regular parishioners, the men and women, not to use birth control, not to have an abortion, but to have more babies because they want more babies in the Catholic Church. My mother, who was a Catholic, married my father, who was a Mason, and my father had to agree before the marriage, before the Catholics would marry the two of them in this mixed marriage, that us kids would be raised in Catholic schools. So, you know, my father agreed. He didn't care. He never went to church. My mom took us, my sister and I, to church. But I went all through, you know, grammar school and Catholic school and college. And actually, I'm glad I did. It was fun. I mean, I learned to rebel against authority. But at a very early age, I was contemplating the universe and you know, eternity and all those things. So I kind of enjoyed my Catholic upbringing. But there's a whole emphasis in the Catholic Church to preserve little babies, but I want you to know the reason for it, and that reason is to make them Catholic so the Catholics will contribute more in the church when they go to the Catholic Church, Mother Church. That's my opinion.
Well, it must be a common objective across the board because most Christian religions, whether they're Catholic or Protestant, seem to preach this idea that we want to have more babies and not practice well, certainly not abortion. Matt, you're doing research about gay men who marry and have families.
Yes.
What's your perspective on this?
Well, I mean, when everybody was making comments, when you were talking, the thing that kept coming to my mind was, you know, whatever happened to love? I mean, the idea of whether it's hatred, let me sow love. I mean, I think that $1 million could have been much better used toward a campaign of creating loving relationships. I would much rather see people focusing on the positives and the things that we can do rather than railing against people. I mean, Mother Teresa, when she was asked back in the Vietnam War to join a rally, a protest against the war, she said, no, I won't. But when there's a march for peace, I'll be there. Mm-hmm. And so it just seems to me that the energy, when even if you're railing against something that you consider to be negative, you're putting more negative energy out there. And one of the teachers that I follow very closely is Dr. Wayne Dyer, and he talks about the idea of the more you love yourself, the more love you have to give. But when you're confronted with people who are different from you, and your reaction is negative or negativity or animus, then that just means that all you have inside is hate. So I think what, for me, and this is my own personal view, I think that there are a lot of well-intentioned Christians, as there are a lot of well-intentioned Muslims, and so on and so forth. But there are also a lot of people who cling to these, you know, organized ideas because they have a lot of struggles in the world. And so, you know, I see religion as an okay thing. It helps you get through life until it becomes a weapon. When it becomes a weapon to put other people down, then that's when I'm totally against it. And what I found in my own research is that almost 99% of the men that I've studied have come from highly religious backgrounds. And I believe, here's the question that I'm often asked, why do some gay men get married to straight women, whereas other gay men either remain closeted or live an openly gay life? And here's what I've determined, and I don't know if this is true, this is my opinion based on the research. I believe that the gay men who end up getting married have a very strong religious attachment, but they also have a very strong need to be accepted. And one of the best tickets to social acceptance is getting married and having children. You walk into a party, you can say, oh, this is my wife. Automatically, your social status has been elevated several times over a single person. So, you know, it's all very complicated, but I think it kind of boils down to one thing. People need to have more love in their lives.
Yes, and less fear. Because I think the politics of hatred are always based upon fear, and a lot of times fear of the unknown. There's all these gay, lesbian, and bisexual people that are closeted out of fear. Then there's all the straight people who don't know that they've got gay, lesbian, and bisexual friends because of fear. And so everybody's living in, you know, this shame-based society where they never talk about the truth.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I am, as just like, you know, to be able to come out of that fear and just open your eyes and see what's really going on here. You know, if you know of a married gay couple and you walk into their home and you see how they're living and you have dinner with them, you know, I think you're going to be hard-pressed to be afraid and hateful. But, you know, if they just become a symbol of a particular cause for you and you never actually get to know them as people, well, it's a lot easier to hate and to stay living in that fear.
Yeah, and Veronica, this is Paul again. I found that in my lifelong relationship with Catholicism, even though I'm a former Catholic, I still follow the events, that the truth seems to be shifting, you know. In all of my Catholic education, I always learned that Mary Magdalene was a prostitute and Christ washed her feet and everything like that. And it wasn't until I read this book, Dan Brown?
The Da Vinci Code.
The Da Vinci Code. And they raised some issues of Mary Magdalene being possibly the wife of Christ, and that Mary Magdalene, there's nothing in the Bible to say that she was a prostitute, but that was invented by, like, Pope Leo 300 AD or something. And I said, well, that's nonsense. I'm going to research it, you know, because of my Catholic upbringing. And this guy's right. You know, I'm reading this novel, and I'm learning things about Christianity that happened historically, which was that there's nothing about Mary Magdalene being a prostitute in the Bible. And indeed, it was this pope around 300 AD that declared her a prostitute. And all of my schooling in Catholic schools, elementary school, high school, and college, she was the prototype prostitute that got converted to Christianity and then became Saint Mary Magdalene, of all things. You know, and the most recent thing in the Catholic dogma that they're thinking of changing, and this was a couple of years ago, I don't think they did, but the whole concept of purgatory. You know, purgatory is that place where you stop off before you get to heaven. You're not bad enough to send to hell, but you go into purgatory and get purged, and then you get promoted to heaven. Well, the church hierarchy was thinking of just throwing it out and saying it didn't exist. And I'm thinking, what the heck? You know, how can you hold on to a concept like all my life, and all of a sudden now it's like something I believe because I learned this, and now they're going to say not to believe it anymore? So it keeps shifting. God, there was something else that's sort of on the tip of my tongue, and I can't quite bring it. Oh, I know. Here it is. Here's one more example. St. George. Well, St. George is a saint because as I'm growing up, St. George went out there and he battled the dragons, and, you know, he killed the dragon, and so he became a saint. Well, once the Catholics accepted the idea that there were no such beasts as dragons, the dragons were merely mythical, and there was no indication of any guy named George in relation to any creature that was anything like a dragon, then they rescinded St. George, so that St. George is no longer a saint. I guess he's just a George.
well, you know, I think religion, and in particular, I'm talking about the monotheistic patriarchal religions, do come out of a cultural background which is very heavily based in the idea of there being royalty. So, you know, if our original government is kings and queens, and they are supposed to be in charge of the peasants by divine right, and that whole model, you know, you've got this god who is also a king, and he might be jealous and vindictive and kind of act like a spoiled brat, but he's God. And so everybody's supposed to worship him unquestioningly. Mm-hmm. And that kind of gets passed down so that then the church leaders get to take some of that on. And I did not grow up in the Catholic Church. I grew up in a little Christian cult called the Worldwide Church of God. But I remember the founder, Herbert W. Armstrong, he had appointed himself the general pastor of this church. It had grown into a pretty big organization. And I'll never forget, I was 18, sitting, you know, in the audience, and he was pounding the podium saying, "How dare you talk behind my back and question me? I am the right hand of Jesus Christ."
No, geez.
and I went, okay, so, you know, I don't ever have to come back to this church because you just committed blasphemy. But, you know, and I needed that permission because I had been raised to be afraid of this man. Like, he wasn't the right hand of God, and if he said something, that's the way it was. And he was becoming incredibly self-serving as he got into his 80s. Everything was about him and for him. But anyway, I think that whole idea of bowing down and serving really sets people up not to question and not to have minds of their own. And also to invalidate all of those intuitive feelings that you might have, that this doesn't seem right. You know, it's just to constantly suppress that and submit to church doctrine. But I'm going to read something off of Facebook here. Jerry, I think you know this person. His name is Robbie Chandler. And this is what he has to say. "Hi, Veronica. I always wonder why churches fail to see the looming population crisis that is coming within the lifetimes of our grandchildren. The population on Earth doubles each 30 years. During World War II, there were only about 2 billion people on Earth. Now there are 6 billion. Within 30 years, there will be 12 billion. But in 60 years, there will be 24 billion people. So where are all the jobs and economic growth going to come from? If religions are so concerned about having babies, what do they plan to do in the lifetime of our grandchildren? Jerry has a granddaughter who is 3 years old. By the time she is 63, there will be 24 billion people on Earth. Will everyone be in a state of poverty?" Anybody want to comment?
Well,
Absolutely right.
Let's let Jerry go first. Jerry, go ahead, honey.
I believe he's absolutely right. I trust this man. I know him well.
Do you want to tell our listeners who Robbie is?
Yes, I believe it.
Yes, you believe it.
And the other thing is that, you know, as a gay man, I tried to make gay babies, and both my boys are straight. How can it be with his mother? Their mother's a lesbian, and I'm gay.
And both of your sons are straight?
Both of my sons are straight. But I tried to make a change.
Well, there goes that theory, huh?
Yes, it really screws that theory up.
Matt, there was something you wanted to say?
Oh, nothing much, really. I mean, I'm not a population expert, but that is kind of alarming.
And, oh, yes. We're pushing 7 billion this year.
Oh, wow. That is crazy. And, you know, actually, I think I heard on the news the other day someone talking about looking into more seriously. This wasn't a joke, but looking more seriously into inhabitable places on another planet. Or in some kind of space station or something like that. I mean, I wonder if, I mean, I don't think our Earth is going to be able to support 24 billion people at one time. I mean, it's just a crazy number of individuals to have on our planet.
Well, I don't understand what the, you know, I myself haven't procreated. Now, I have some comprehension and empathy for the whole process because I did get pregnant for 3 months, and I definitely wanted to have that baby. So I understand the hormones kick in, and boy, they just kind of take over your life. But before you come under the progesterone estrogen cocktail spell, it seems like you could use your brain to say, you know, maybe I can't afford children, maybe the Earth can't afford more children, and, you know, what's really, if I really love children, this is what, forgive the terminology, but I'm just going to go ahead and be queer for a moment and say breeders. when breeders talk about children, they talk about how much they love them, but then they'll spend $10,000 trying to get the right egg and the right sperm to get united instead of going out to an orphanage and adopting these children that they say they love.
Right on.
Well, I think it does kind of come back to, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Matt.
I was just going to say, I think it does somewhat come back to our own sense of ego, wanting to procreate from our own DNA and, you know, seeing children as sort of an extension of ourselves. I mean, I see nothing wrong with having children. I think it's a wonderful thing. I don't personally have any, and I don't expect that I will. But why can't governments around the world start adopting a policy where they limit the number of children that families can have? Like, there are some Asian countries that have already done that. You know, because there's enough space for all those children.
Check this out. China just lifted their one family, one child.
Yes.
And now,
yes.
They're now encouraging couples to have a second child.
Are they now, really?
Yeah.
Last I heard, it was one child per family. That created a lot of difficulties for the family. Some of the kids I ended up with at Oakland High when I was teaching were kids that came from China through Vietnam to America, and the reason their parents left China is they wanted to have more than one child, you know. It also created sort of a child-selling situation where some couples, sadly, could make money by selling a child, and other childless people out there could buy that child. And the figure I heard was something like 70 million children around the world were being sold, bought and sold every year, sadly. Going back to the original projection, I kind of disagree with it, given survival of the fittest and Darwinian type of natural selection. We'd probably have a lot more people on Earth right now if it wasn't for the Second World War, you know, like more people in America if we hadn't lost a combination of 600,000 North and South troops in this country, you know, during the 1860s. So there's a natural selection, and there's these famines that come along now and then. But I think the biggest problem of against the natural selection is the medicines. I mean, instead of survival of the fittest, people take medicine and we have survival of the unfittest, you know. I mean, people who otherwise would be dying of a natural death are expanding their life and they're living longer. And it's really, I don't think the problem is really too many people being born, but not enough people dying soon enough. Excluding me, of course. I want to keep living.
I totally agree with that. We have a lot of long living but unhealthy people, just like we have a lot of overweight people who are malnourished.
Malnutrition, rather.
Wait, though, but I have to say, I think that, you know, the whole idea is that we should be evolving. Whether you believe in evolution or not, we should be evolving to, you know, expanded consciousness and hopefully adapting to our surroundings. And if we, and I think those of us who are alive, you know, it's going to be very difficult to convince any one person to give up the idea that they could extend their life or the quality of their life. So that probably sounds like a non-starter to me. But to get people to stop investing so much ego in procreation, you know, we can halt these technologies that are developing ways that people who can't even naturally have children go into a laboratory to try to have children. It's unnecessary. The world doesn't need to figure out more ways to make babies, in my opinion. What we need to do is to figure out ways to take care of the people that are already here to the best of our ability. And I think we're at a time in our history where we need to remove the religious taboos around talking about you know, population growth. And, you know, usually when you institute laws, just like you were pointing out, Paul, laws create a lot of difficulties. This is one of the reasons that I always, you know, speak out in favor of decriminalizing prostitution, because passing laws against anything, prohibiting anything, even when they have prohibition against alcohol, it always creates a black market. It always creates an underbelly of crime. And so I wouldn't be in favor of telling people you can only have one child, but I would be in favor of removing the shame around birth control, of removing the misinformation around birth control, and giving people all of these wonderful options, and then perhaps educating people to the idea that there would be some kind of ego gratification in adopting as opposed to procreating. But what do you guys think about that?
Well, I agree with it in theory, absolutely, and I think it's always better to educate people rather than force them to act in a certain way. But I guess this is kind of a jaundiced view, but I think there are a lot of uneducated people in our society who aren't going to follow basic common sense, no matter how much education is out there, and so I don't know, I guess I'm of a mixed mind.
Well, and, you know, the statistics would bear that to be true, Matt, because statistically, if you have a college education and a high income, you are less likely to procreate. And if you happen to be at the poverty level and have an eighth grade education, you're more likely to have a whole bunch of kids.
But I think you're right. I think it's probably better to come from an education place rather than creating this negative side to a law.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I'm not sure what country it was, but it's India. India is trying to find a way to cut down on their population growth, so they are on a mission to get televisions into all the homes because they have discovered that late-night television reduces the population growth.
Good idea.
Okay.
You know.
You have something to do, right?
Yeah, right. It's something to do. As a sexologist, I don't know if I'm really in favor of that. What I'd really like to do is start educating people to some non-procreative ways to have sex. But there again, we butt up against religious shame because, the religious doctrine usually preaches against masturbation and mutual masturbation and oral sex and anal sex and BDSM, anything that might give you an orgasmic release that doesn't lead to creating a baby becomes a taboo.
Oh, and they're lots of fun.
Well, and much healthier for you.
Yeah.
for you personally, since a lot of them do not risk sexually transmitted diseases, and much better for the planet.
Maybe to reduce the number of births, they should institute a tax incentive. So the fewer kids you have, the less taxes you have to pay. Maybe that would be an inducement.
I think we need to start teaching Tantra in the Catholic schools.
Teaching what?
Okay.
Tantra. Fire breath
orgasms.
Tantra. You can have fire breath orgasms without even touching yourself. How could you find fault with that?
You ought to send the Pope a copy of this, a transcript of this conversation. What do you think?
I might have to.
Pope, what's his name? Benedict, Pope Benedict. I remember reading that when Benedict came to the United States and he visited with President Bush, he complained to President Bush there was too much democracy in America, and they got to get the American government should get control of the people and show the people how to do the right thing and all this type of stuff, that he didn't like the people of America having so much freedom.
Unbelievable. Well, there you go again. It's coming out of a monarchy approach to life. You guys, we're getting down to our last 4 minutes here. I want to give everybody a chance to kind of say their last things about, you know, religious shame. And in particular, you know, we got off on this whole population thing because I think that really is tied into the homophobia. But we were really talking about, you know, closeting and persecuting gay people. So, Jerry, is there anything, final words that you'd like to say as somebody who loves God and is getting told that you're going to go to hell?
Well, I would, for me, acceptance and love is what I was looking for. And nobody could hurt me if I didn't love them. And when your own family votes you out of the family because you're a homosexual, it hurts so deeply. And then they vote you out, but when you're dying, they come back in to escort you to hell. That's even worse.
I'm sorry, I'm laughing, but it's so utterly stupid, I can't help myself. Jerry, I know this stuff really hurts, sweetheart, and I know the people that are involved, and I think it's horrible, but I hope that, you know, when you hear me laugh at this, you know I'm laughing at just how insane they are.
Well, and especially the one person who, when I was 5 years old, started a sexual relationship with me that lasted for 3 years, and then when I'm in the hospital dying and paralyzed and can't say anything, and the nurse is holding the phone to my ear, says, I know we've had our history, but I'm saved, and I'm going to get you saved, too, before you go out. You know, I couldn't even speak back and say, you hypocrite, you dirty bastard.
I'm sorry, Jerry. Okay. Well, that man's my uncle, and I will be the first to say he should have gone to prison a long time ago.
You know, I have no shame for my life. I have lived it and loved it.
Yeah.
That's all I have to say.
Well, you live well, Jerry. You live well, and as far as I'm concerned, you're a role model for the rest of us. Matt?
Well, thank you, Veronica.
I love you, Jerry.
Thank you.
Matt, is there anything you'd like to say in closing?
Well, to Jerry, I totally accept you. And, you know, anybody who doesn't, you know, they're off the rocker. But, I guess the only thing I would reiterate about religion is that when people judge me, I just try to love them back because I don't want to be party to creating more hate. And I think that's, it's just my own philosophy, and it's one that I think that a lot of religious people could adopt and really live the tenets that they so often spout.
Yeah. Couldn't agree more. Paul, anything else you'd like to say?
Yeah, just to maybe give a juxtaposition to the shame.
You have 2 minutes left on this call.
And avant-garde love-making people or peace-making people now and then. There's a French theologian, I read this book over 20 years ago, Talleyrand Deschardin, and he wrote a book called The Omega the alpha and the omega point, and his point was that we're not totally civilized people right now because we perpetuate individual and national violence upon each other. And the time when we actually become fully civilized is going to be that time when we love each other in an agape type of world, and there is no individual violence against each other, and there's no national violence against each other. And when we reach that point, we will have become truly civilized human beings in humanity in the true sense of the word. I like his way of thinking, so I just thought I'd throw that in there.
Thank you, Paul. And I'm going to have the last say here and just say that if any of you found that this program stirred up emotions, please send me an email, veronica@sexwithoutshame.com. Be happy to have follow-up conversations with you, or you can, of course, Twitter me or find me on Facebook and put something on my wall. Yes, I agree with all of you. We want to create more love and more acceptance, and hopefully we can start a dialogue with everybody, regardless of what our spiritual and religious viewpoints are. That's it for the Shame Free Zone for tonight. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with me.
Sering kesepian.